3 of this lightning fast edition, the lightning round edition of Justice Andrew is underway.
Need to make that a revolving door.
So much for spending some time and listening with us this morning and all of our guests. If you missed any of the show earlier today, get that iHeartRadio app, subscribe to the Justice Andrew channel. We've had Twyla Braze, Nick Zerwas, and Kim Crockett already on the show, and we still have coming up Jason Flores from Americans for Prosperity and Katie Pavlich. So just stay glued to your radio for the next hour.
Yeah, there's an opioid bill on the Senate floor today. So from Americans for Prosperity, again, Jason Flores will be joining us a little bit later on in this half hour.
But now joining us is GOP gubernatorial candidate Philip Parrish. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
First time we've had you on the show since you've been running. So let's start at the beginning. Tell listeners who may not be familiar with you, tell them a little bit about yourself, who you are, what your background is, and what prompted you, what was the catalyst for you to jump into this gubernatorial race?
You bet. So I was born and raised here in Minnesota. I went to college at Mankato at Minnesota State University, then Mankato State University. Become a teacher. I taught K-12 music for 13 years here in Minnesota, and I became a principal, and I got a job in Austin, Minnesota as a principal and director of education at Girard Treatment Programs, New Dominion School, and we specialize in emotional behavioral disorders. In the midst of my education career, I'm still a licensed principal to this day. I had joined the Navy Reserve as an intelligence specialist, enlisted, and in the enlisted ranks for 9.5 years, and then I was offered a direct commission as an intelligence officer, and I specialize in counterterrorism and foreign policy. Over the years, it'll be 20 years this July, I've done a lot of work with law enforcement partners around the world, and a lot of those threads of working with trying to figure out the who, what, when, where, and why, a lot of those threads kept coming back to Minnesota, money laundering, terrorist activities, support of extremist groups inside the U.S. and overseas, and front companies in Minnesota that are exploiting our social services programs. These kinds of things prompted me to get more and more concerned, start talking with leaders, and I couldn't find somebody who was really standing up and telling the truth about how badly we're being exploited. And after a few conversations, I said, it's time to throw my hat in the ring and really start standing up for the truth and doing the best I can to speak about some really hard issues in a very dignified and respectful way.
Talk a little bit about you've received some pushback in looking and doing some background, and thank you for your service, first and foremost. But you've received some pushback based off some comments you've made, especially in regards to your background and your insight into terrorism and the immigration issue. Speak a little bit about that, because again, doing some research on your background, some of the first things that pop up are some, you know, a City Page article and some other comments about comments you've made, and wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of explain what that was all about and get your thoughts on it.
You bet. Yeah. You know, I've already been called a racist, a bigot, a Islamophobe, all kinds of craziness. And the bottom line is I'm out here talking about the truth on the ground of what's actually happening legally. At the end of the day, it's regardless of race, color, creed, or religion. The fact is we're being exploited in our social services programs to the tune of actually hurting our communities. And those who are in genuine need, those who are genuinely coming here for assistance, they're suffering as well, because the people that are exploiting the programs far outweigh the number of people who are actually in genuine need. And you don't have to believe me about that. You can do some research of your own. You can do the Center of American Experiment. Kim Crockett, by the way, wonderful pieces on these types of issues. So what happened in the particular articles that had to do with a big pushback had to do with Regina Mustafa in Rochester, Minnesota, and wanted to have a faith dialogue meeting. And I pushed back and said, well, first of all, it's not my, and I'm paraphrasing because you probably have read the letters, it's not my role as governor to have a faith dialogue experience in the first place. Our role as a government, our proper role, is to assure that we're following the Constitution, state and federal, and make sure we're following the law. If you're having relationship issues with faith or interfaith dialogue, you need to solve that. You need to get on board with talking with people and start talking, telling the truth about what's going on with their interfaith dialogue. It's not the role of the government to have an interfaith dialogue, in my opinion. I also push back that we need to renounce or denounce the Sharia, Islamic law. And we need to denounce these behaviors of exploiting our citizens and exploiting those who are actually in need and exposing the people who are disingenuous. And you're not a bad person if you stand up and tell the truth. You're not a bad person. You're not a bigot or a racist if you look at somebody and say, you're doing something wrong and it needs to stop. It's nothing to do with race, color, or creed, or religion. It's to do with your behavior is unacceptable and you're hurting people. That's what I'm trying to get across.
You entered this race as a relative unknown on the statewide political stage. How have you been sort of spreading your agenda, your message, your name recognition, and what are some of the challenges that you faced in that process?
Well, one of the jumps I had was, again, I taught school for 13 years and here in Minnesota, and I was K-12 music teacher, so thousands of students who are now adults and have adult children, which is really interesting. Makes me old, feel old when I see them. Hey, Mr. Parrish, how are you doing? So the name recognition is far bigger than what the pundits and the political advisors really want to admit to. I started a year ago, actually. I announced in January of last year, and I started in April full-time trying to run around Minnesota and talk with people. We've been meeting with groups three to five nights a week in the early times, and now it's sometimes 5 to 7 nights a week, sometimes 2 events a day, anywhere from 10, 15, 20, a couple hundred people at a time. And so the message has been out there, actually shaking thousands of hands and speaking with thousands of people and actually sitting down and listening. I think the thing that I'm really getting known for is you ask me to come somewhere and ask me to sit down and visit, people really understand that I'm there to listen, and I'm there to actually document concerns and document observations people are having. And we've gotten a great deal of respect for that, even from some of our competitors. And we have an awesome team led by Connie Thorpe, and the executive committee has been doing amazing work. We just keep surprising everybody because we're just that darn good and that efficient and that effective.
Did the campaign change much at all with the entrance? And we've talked about this with the other candidates. But did the campaign, your campaign, change much at all with the entrance of Tim Pawlenty?
Not really. I'm a little disappointed. I'll be genuine here. I'm very disappointed in Mr. Pawlenty's behavior and the behavior of some disingenuous people, in my opinion.
In what respect?
Well, the thing is that if you take a look at the record and you take a real good look at the concerns we have today with regards to the exploitation of resettlement programs, with regards to Common Core and Agenda 21, which Agenda 21 is real, by the way. It's not some kind of fantasy or right-wing conspiracy. It's a real problem. Common Core is a real problem. The completely destabilization of many of our retirement programs in Minnesota throughout many of the different industries. The energy issue, we're in a situation with the energy crisis that's going to come before you know it. And as soon as the nuclear plant closes, we have a destabilization of our energy infrastructure that's going to come to the surface. All of these things are due to policies and things that took place during Mr. Pawlenty's time. Remember also how bad off the GOP ended up towards the end of Mr. Pawlenty's terms as well, and we had someone nearly go to jail for finance issues. These kinds of things, what I'm talking about, disingenuousness, if there are GOP people out there that are all on board all of a sudden running after this alleged big money, it's alleged big money, by the way, and number one. Number two, remember what that led to last time. So when I say disingenuous, people who are, oh, my goodness, the Savior is here, it's bunk. It's absolute garbage. It's just not true, and it's going to be exposed. It's going to take some good, hard, decent work to expose it, but it's just not a winning ticket. It's just not a winning prospect.
Are you gunning for the endorsement at the convention, or are you looking ahead to a potential primary?
I'm going for the endorsement, period.
That's it.
And my prediction is that two of us are going to team up, and we're going to knock it so far out of the park that Tim Walz won't even be able to get on the field to play.
What do you mean two of us are going to team up?
To the state convention, you're going to see two of us come together, and we're going to be...
Two of the current candidates?
Two of the current candidates are going to come together and be governor and lieutenant governor. I'm going to win the endorsement, and I'm going to ask one of my top competitors to be my lieutenant governor.
Do you have somebody specific in mind?
Yes, I do, sir.
Can you reveal that to us at this time?
I'm going to leave that between he and I.
Okay.
Well, you're discussing talking with again Phil Parrish, candidate for governor. As we continue, is there a place where people can find out more about you?
Absolutely. So parrishformn.com. That's Parrish with two R's, the number 4. MN.com.
You've raised a number of different issues in the course of our conversation that are going to be, for lack of a better word, sort of triggering to individuals when you hear them. You know, we discussed a bit of the immigration issue. You also mentioned Agenda 21. Those are not particular, especially with Agenda 21, those are not particularly issues that have sort of the broader support of the individuals you need to go and reach. How do you reach out to the individuals who, if they hear that, and just to be honest, you're going to get a bit of the eye roll from some people. How do you reach those individuals when you talk about those particular issues? That seems like it would be a bit of a stumbling block.
Yeah, honestly, we already have. And the notion that it is a stumbling block, and this is not criticism of you, I'm just telling you,
sure,
the people on the ground investigating thousands of people we've spoken to across Minnesota, 80% plus of the people that come to our gatherings, they're all talking like I do. They're all talking like a lot of very concerned, decent Minnesota citizens talk. And the majority of them are coming across party lines. They're coming from Independent, they're coming from Green Party, they're coming from the GOP, they're coming from Democratic Party. The number of people that have, I'm not just feeding you a line, the number of people that have come to me from the Democratic Party and said, I've had enough, is far bigger than the pundits and the press want to admit to. And they're scared. And they're showing they're scared by in a complete minimization of myself and my team and those who support me. They're marginalizing us to the point where they're exposing their bias. That's how bad it is in Minnesota, and how many of us out there, the greater majority of us, truly get that our schools are in trouble, our energy crisis is in trouble, our senior citizens and retirees are treated like absolute garbage, expendable assets that leave the state, by the way, at 30 to 33% per year. These people are really genuinely concerned, and they're really motivated this year, and they're going to come to the polls this year, and they're going to pull across party lines, and we can win this thing. The message is getting across to everyone.
Philip Parrish, give out your website one more time.
Parrishformn.com. P-A-R-R-I-S-H, the number 4, MN.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. Pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Before we get we move over to our next guest coming up here in just a few minutes, we do want to provide a bit of an update on the story that we covered at length yesterday. This comes out of the Star Tribune. The Edina School Board decided, we talked about the issue with the teacher, the vice chairman, Sarah Patzloff, who came under fire recently over a social media post. The board said in a statement on Wednesday that an independent investigation has concluded the matter is closed. The board held a closed-door meeting, as we discussed, Tuesday to discuss complaints against Patzloff regarding a Facebook post where she dare criticize a lengthy blog post by a 10th grade English teacher in Edina schools. And look, we read from a bunch of that blog post. Man, there were parts of that read like a portion of a communist manifesto. It really did.
If I were a teacher at that school, if I were a parent with students at that school, I would have concerns as well. And it's really troubling that all this teacher did was express some of those concerns in a private Facebook group, not for public consumption. And a mole outed her
right
to the school board, and she was by some accounts, forced to issue this apology.
This was in regards to English teacher Jackie Rule's blog, Voices from the Inside. On a private Facebook post, as Drew mentioned, for Edina parents, it called the manifesto frightening. The blog made the case for teaching students about racial and social issues. One of the quotes, and again, this is from the Star Tribune article, overall, educators must understand that despite the fact that discussing issues of race, racism, and whiteness is uncomfortable, they need to experience that discomfort to affect real change. And look, that was the most benign of the things that this 10th grade teacher, Jackie Ruel, wrote in this blog. Thankfully, she was able to keep her job, but not before she had to go and issue an apology.
I would like to express my regret for posting comments on Facebook that were upsetting to some members of our community. It wasn't my intent to offend anyone, and I will continue to strongly advocate for our students and hope that we can put this matter behind us and focus our attention on the work of the district.
And it seems pretty clear, too, that the fact that she was allowed to simply apologize speaks to a bit of the benign nature of which she called into question this, and it legitimately deserved being called into question, this blog post by this 10th grade teacher. If she had made any egregious comments, is more of what I'm saying, beyond right. It's frightening, right. I don't think for a second she wouldn't have been walked out the door. In this, the statement also had, and there was a school board chairman that also decided, Lenny Wallen Friedman had comments following her apology.
As everyone is aware, the school board met tonight to review a complaint against one of our members. The district was required by its policies and practices to fully investigate this matter, and that independent investigation has now concluded.
Could you speak
no formal there? Disciplinary action will be taken against Ms. Patzloff, and the district considers this matter to be closed. No further information may be shared regarding the allegations or the details of the investigation, as such data is classified as private personnel data on Ms. Patzloff. The board would like to thank those individuals who took part in this process and is looking forward to moving past this matter to continue its focus on the best interest of students, parents, staff, and the Edina community.
Not with you as chair.
As always, we remain committed to ensuring that our students receive an excellent education.
Really?
With that, we can finish our meeting.
Look, at the end of this article...
Snarky comments thrown in there by the peanut gallery.
I like that peanut gallery. I think that me and that peanut gallery should hang out.
It is sassy.
Yeah, that would be me if I was at that meeting.
And a bit of context on this whole thing. This school board dispute is the district's just latest flare-up over politics and free speech, as we talked about on the show at length as well. Back in March, members of the Edina High School's Young Conservatives Club had to settle a lawsuit after claiming the district had wrongfully revoked its school-sponsored status. The district denied that particular claim. We mentioned yesterday at the Center of the American Experiment Forum that we went to with Candace Owens speaking, when there was a student at the school that spoke up about how she went to that school, the whole crowd knew what was going on.
Yeah, the entire crowd groaned.
Yeah. There's so much hypocrisy going on at that school. It's unbelievable.
And look, if you've been following this story, you've been following the sort of the insane path that Edina is going down. Just understand, your school district, if they're not already there, they'll be there in a couple years.
Oh, they're
going to be in the same exact spot that Edina is, because it's getting infiltrated by people with agendas that have nothing to do with actually educating your kids and providing your kids with a quality education. They've got ideological agendas at play here going on in the Edina school district, and this is all a part of it. The fact that they have moles out there scouring social media looking for teachers or administrators or staff that might possibly stray from the approved thought reservation, and outing them and making the argument that they should be fired over this, that's terrifying.
Katie Pavlich joins us just after 8:30 from Fox News next. There's an opioid bill that'll be on the Senate floor today. We're going to be talking with Jason Flores, Americans for Prosperity, to get you up to speed about what this bill is all about and what you need to know next on Twin Cities News Talk. It is Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Justice and Drew, along with Sam. Use the hashtag TCNT. I know we got Jason Flores on hold, Drew, but I'm going to pull an audible. I don't know if you know this or not, but The solo.
I thought Kim Jong Un was calling in this.
Well, no, he couldn't make. He couldn't make it. He was.
We had to reschedule.
Yeah, he was. Right. Yeah, he was. He was busy. but tonight the solo Star Wars story is premiering in Los Angeles, and I'm very. So we're going to talk about that the rest of the show.
So you're leaving right after the show, hitting the airport?
Yeah. Oh, I wish. No, I'm looking forward to the Twitter reactions after the premiere tonight. They built a full scale Millennium Falcon on Hollywood Boulevard. Absolutely, I wish I was there.
Yeah, I bet.
I want to live in it.
A lot of fun.
Because up here, I already do.
Jason Flores, Americans for Prosperity. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, guys. How are you doing today?
You just had to come on, didn't you? You know,
I heard everybody else on.
Coming on. Talking about Star Wars. So I had to get on.
he heard all our other guests. He was like, I got to get part of this.
I got to get in on
they're,
this.
They're having a party, and I wasn't invited.
Like this, you're doing like this speed dating thing on the radio this morning.
Yeah, we really are. It's kind of crazy.
All right, we got an opioid bill on the Senate floor today. What's it all about, and why do people need to know about it?
Well, the opioid bill that's on the Senate floor today, what the goal, which is a very well-meaning goal and one that I think a lot of us would agree with, is they're trying to find, they're dedicating money to more of a state response to the opioid crisis. There's no question it's a crisis that needs a response here in Minnesota and across the country. That's why you've seen federal money dedicated to it. And this bill would raise additional money. The problem is that the way they're raising that money is they're just increasing costs on prescription drugs. Now, they started out with a per-pill opioid fee that looked more like a traditional tax. They've changed that now, and they're calling it a registration fee on the drug companies, the wholesalers, and the providers. Well, the problem is that no matter how you cut it, whether it's a fee, a tax, or something in between, this is still going to add costs for people who are already struggling to afford their health care in Minnesota.
Exactly.
They're doing this at a time when we've got a budget surplus. There's no question that Minnesota, somewhere in a $50 billion biennial budget, can find room for $20 million of opioid response. That much of a crisis and that much of a need, which I believe it is.
Does this have, what kind of support do we know does this have? I'm hoping not a lot.
Well, it's a little bit split. I mean, folks, legislators are definitely trying to find a response. They want to be able to say on the campaign trail this summer that they did something in regard to the opioid epidemic. And when the legislature does that, usually they try to find money. And certainly there are programs that are going to be funded by money in this bill that would be a good thing. Our problem is completely the how it's funded, because we're already taxing Minnesotans enough. Especially, Minnesota has been in the business of getting out of the way of adding government costs to healthcare for a long time right now. That's one thing they can control in healthcare. So I don't know why we're going backwards here. As far as support, I think it's questionable. Obviously, the slim majority in the Senate with more traditional liberals there who have sought to raise taxes on way more things than just healthcare. I mean, that makes it a little tougher over there. And so if you have a few folks willing to go across that line. But there's Republicans and Democrats that are supporting this. And that's unfortunate because, again, we're not disagreeing with the fact that the opioid crisis needs a response. But adding additional government-imposed costs on the backs of folks already struggling to afford their health care, that's not the way to do it.
Yeah, look, on that point alone, so let's start here. On that point alone, no. I'm just not on board with it, because I absolutely agree with you. The other, even if that was arguable, the other problem and the concern that I have is that this attitude towards this problem, that we can solve it by just getting a whole bunch of money. It's not that simple. And my fear is that we're actually not going to be looking at doing other things to deal with this very complicated issue if we kind of go with this blanket, oh, we'll just tax this and we'll have a bunch of money to go and fight it. No, man, this is a complicated issue that goes well beyond just gathering a whole bunch of, you know, taxpayer dollars.
No, absolutely. And now, to the legislature's credit, they are working on other things as well. They're not getting as much as headline as this. And like I said before, legislators always want to come home and they want to say, we gave money for this and we did money for that. We gave money for that, but it's all taxpayers' dollars. And in this case, it's taxpayers' health care dollars that the legislature is already spending money to buy down the cost of health care, that, you know, help subsidize that for people. So why are we adding additional costs? Now, we sent a key vote letter over to the Senate today, and we've been tracking this and communicating with legislators throughout the process. And the thing that we've encouraged them to do is to do the things that they can in terms of access to those prescription drugs. And not to forget that a big chunk of this opioid crisis isn't caused by prescription drugs. It's not caused by, the leftover drugs when grandma's prescription runs out or by filling prescriptions that you don't need. A big part of this is actual criminal activity, actual synthetic opioids that are trafficked as street drugs. We can't forget that, and yet this proposed solution only focuses on taxes on prescription drugs.
Yeah, I love how they spin it. You know, they spin it like it's a fee on the providers, a fee on the pharmaceutical companies. They're not dumb, and they know better. That is, this is not a fee that the pharmaceutical companies are just going to eat. This is a fee that is going to be passed on to the people that are using these drugs responsibly, that are in need of these drugs to deal with their own chronic pain issues, and who have who bear no responsibility for the blow up in the opioid crisis whatsoever. Yet suddenly we're burdening them with paying for some undefined, vague response from government that just they just need more money to implement. It offends me.
Yeah, and I think the hardest part for me in this recent shift to this registration fee a la New York, they say, well, New York did it, and I say that's all the more reason not to do it.
right, yeah.
Why would we want to do anything New York does?
Basically the bottom line. But my problem is on the exact point that you just brought up. Look, especially the Republicans in the Senate or the conservatives in the Senate, they get it, right? That's why they've been attacking the governor on his billion-dollar proposal to reinstate the sick tax, because they know that that 2% provider tax, as they call it, gets passed on to consumers. And yet this opioid proposal is absolutely no different. Now, maybe because it's well-meaning, because they are addressing a opioid crisis that we all know is a problem in Minnesota, that gives them leave to go against those principles or to say that, oh, no, this tax or fee won't get passed on, but the governor's sick tax would. I mean, it's just, you have to be consistent in this. Both of those proposals are bad because they would raise costs on people who are already struggling to afford their health care.
What's the per pill? What's the proposal again?
So this is Senate File 730.
Right.
It'll be up on the Senate floor today. Now, there's a companion bill moving in the House, but the House is doing the right thing. They're using existing funds out of the general fund.
Okay.
I mean, look, when we have a surplus, even whether it's small or it's bigger, and it's, you know, $300-something million this year, when we have a surplus, we shouldn't be raising additional taxes. The House gets that. They're funding this out of the general fund. They're finding it within the general fund budget because this is a priority, and that's where we should be funding our priorities from. And so they're doing it the right way. The Senate, though, is moving with this additional new revenue and a little bit of a punitive idea on drug companies, again, that is going to hurt them and not ultimately hurt the consumer.
What was the cost per pill? Is this the one where it was per pill?
They switched it from the cost per pill to this registration fee style that New York went with.
Okay.
To try to get it away from, as if that changes the argument.
Right.
That this is not going to get passed on. So it's one more level of government opaqueness getting in the way, and yet still just pass on to consumers.
Yeah.
So now it's just a couple flat punitive registration fees, $20 million of registration fees just for wholesalers and companies to do business here and distribute opioids.
You know, and the part of this too, and just to double down on it again, and speaking to, unfortunately, personal experience, man, this stuff adds up. A lot of times when you've got individuals, when this cost is added to the price of this type of a prescription pain medication, it's not just that the individual is going and paying for. There's a lot of times there's other things that you go and have to have prescriptions for because you're dealing with some other ailment. And I know that to be true with me. And trust me, when you go and add up those bills, when you go over to your Walgreens or your CVS, you know when that's gone up because you know how much you pay. That money adds up quickly. And I don't want that passed off to me potentially. If I have to have and get these pain medications again, why am I the one who has to go and shoulder that burden?
And it's not like this is discretionary income that's being taxed.
Right.
You have to have these things or you might die.
Right.
And if you want to get into the economic side of it, that's why putting these fees on the prescription companies won't work, because they know that when they're selling these in Minnesota, they are needed. People aren't going to
get your stuff.
The same cost option here as you do. You're taking these pills or not.
Yeah, you're stuck. You don't have a choice in the matter. You know, and it happens to us like every single year. Like when we have to, when we switch, when the insurance kicks in, you know, and you have to go through the deductible process again, there's that series of months where, all right, we got to meet the deductible. So we got to pay through the roof for the cost of our prescription medication until we've paid that down. That stuff adds up. You don't have a choice. I can't sit there and bargain with my healthcare provider to try to get the cost limited. So yeah, this is bad. Tell them to knock it off. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate it.
Well, that's what we're doing. We sent our key vote letter over, and we've had action alerts up all week. You can visit our website, AmericansForProsperity.org. You'll get directed to a spot where even today, it's not too late to make your voice heard. Give a call to your Minnesota senator. Call their office. Leave a message for them. Send them an email and let them know that, hey, that we support doing something about the opioid crisis. There is a role for government in this. But raising costs on patients is not that role.
Jason Flores, Americans for Prosperity. Give out that website one more time.
AmericansForProsperity.org or follow us on Twitter at ProsperityMN.
All right, and I encourage everybody to contact your lawmaker, contact your senator, your legislator. Let them know that this is a terrible idea, that you shouldn't be putting the burden of solving this opioid crisis on those that are using these drugs responsibly, using them correctly, and need them to get by on their day-to-day. Thank you so much, Jason. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks,
guys. Take
care. We're going to be talking with Katie Pavlich from Fox News here in just a minute. You know, Drew, we haven't had a chance to get to a lot of the other big stories today.
We haven't gotten to anything.
Right? So I got to... Well, this one needs to be talked about, Rue. I got a quick one for you. Have either of you guys... You ever used Magic Shell with your ice cream? You ever used Magic Shell? Okay.
Yeah.
So if you've had experience with Magic Shell,
imagine,
you know...
you're a big fan of it.
A huge... I love Magic Shell. Yeah, so good.
I had a feeling.
It's so good.
It is so good. The problem with Magic Shell, though, is that when you're done...
mixed with Zima?
When you're done... Stop. Because there's only enough time. There's only jokey jokes. So you
no time for your jokes.
When you're done with the Magic Shell, if your bowl is cold, it gets stuck to the bowl. It makes it really hard to get off, right? You got to soak it for a while. So one of the stories we didn't get really important to you, and chance to get you today, this comes out of Warsaw, Poland.
Okay.
A tractor trailer overturned on a Polish highway, and it spilled tons of liquid chocolate that is now solidifying.
No, God, please, no! No!
It's now solidifying into a huge sticky mess.
No!
How cold is it there that the chocolate solidified? It should be warm enough this time of year that you.
Well,
think
I think
it
it's like, you know, if you pour out a bunch of Hershey's chocolate syrup and leave it out, it's going to get gooey.
Plus, in Poland, the seasons are reversed.
Yeah,
that's not true.
And they don't have to abide by the same types.
They're in our hemisphere.
I thought you'd fall for it.
They don't have to abide by the same
been to the area
chocolatey standards that we do. So they've got the good chocolate syrup. You know, we've got pesky rules and regulations. You want the good chocolate syrup?
You got to go to Poland.
That's right.
Yeah.
Rescue officials said the liquid chocolate was solidifying as it cooled and would require large amounts of hot water to clear away and the biggest spoon that Poland was able to find.
They could borrow ours. We've got a really big
spoon. Oh, yeah!
Oh,
I totally planned that.
Yeah,
way to bring it. Way to bring a local.
Good Minnesota tie-in.
Warsaw, Poland story.
Yeah.
Yeah, the driver had to be taken to the hospital with a broken arm.
If you see a bunch of shady looking individuals, dismantling the spoon, now you know why.
They said, God, the shipping costs on that.
Sending it to Poland.
The fire brigade captain in the region. Wow, said the cooling chocolate was worse than snow.
But it's so tasty.
Yeah, I know, right?
How many people do you think? I mean, you know,
you
there's got to be people walking around just like cutting
gross
up chunks
that would
of chocolate.
Be.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like, oh, it's a Willy Wonka in real life. Like, no, that sounds horrible.
It's going to be full of debris and dirt.
Ugh.
But you know that there's crazy Polish people eating it.
They're out there licking the road right now.
Yeah, I hope there's no big ants there. You know, because they're attracted to
the shit. You want ants? Because that's how you get ants.
Exactly.
Justice.
Drew, I have to apologize.
What did you do now?
Twin Cities News Talk, Justice and Drew, along with Sam. Probably had to apologize to Sam, too. I was giving her a hard time a moment ago. I wasn't trying to.
It's mine.
Now she earned it.
There's a listener on Twitter. You know, I stopped you for making jokey jokes. And he said it was the only reason why he listens to the show was your jokes.
Ah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, jokes on him, wow, but I do apologize for cutting you off there.
That guy has terrible taste.
Way to ruin that guy's day, John.
Sorry. I can go back and do the Warsaw Poland story again about the chocolate spill.
No, I'm good.
All right, you good, good with that? All right.
Yeah, I'm good.
Fox News contributor, excellent shot. Lover of boots, Katie Pavlich. Good morning, Katie. How are we doing this morning?
Allegedly a good shot. That's what the people tell me. Hey. Lots of people are saying
the word on the street is that Katie's got a good aim. I don't know if you know that or not. Hey, we do have to talk about serious issues with you. First off, most serious, why are you getting into a fight with Alyssa Milano?
Oh, you know, because she just deserves to be confronted in the cyber war. That's all I have to say.
It is so much fun to do a quick Google search on you, and then, you know, this pops up from Twitchy. It's so on. Katie Pavlich shreds Alyssa Milano for nasty lie about NRA and our troops.
Yeah, I mean, she like most Hollywood elitists who want to take guns away from people like you and me, right? When they say they don't want guns in the wrong hands include us. They actually don't know anything about what they're protesting. So, you know, they don't really know what an NRA member looks like. They don't hang out with them. Instead of going into the convention and maybe talking to some people and trying to have a dialogue, they stood outside and protested across the street with armed security, by the way. So, you know, she's reached out to me before claiming she wants to have an honest conversation about these things. She launched a website that she said was going to promote both sides of the issue. But, you know, I just don't buy
silly.
It. Yep. They just don't know that, you know, they just claim to know who we are, and they really don't know much.
No. Yeah. Yeah. And that's abundant. That's abundant. That's abundantly clear. All right. Mm-hmm. Let's move over to some serious matters, and let's talk Israel and what's going on with Iran. And, you know, I kind of want to do something that we've done before and hand it off to you. I mean, we've got a number of different factors involved here. One being President Donald Trump backing out of this Iran nuke deal. Prior to that, as we talked about last week, we had this exposure that Benjamin Netanyahu did with the data that was taken out of Iran, talking about how they hadn't stopped their endeavors into nuclear weapons. And now we've got this new phase, the altercations overnight, and kind of hand it off to you. Where do you want to go with this? Where do we want to start this discussion? What are you looking at right now with what's happening?
Yeah, so I guess we'll start with the most current news, which is overnight, the Israeli Air Force took out a number of Iranian military sites in Syria after the Iranians, both in retaliation for the U.S. decision on the Iran deal, but also because they hate Israel, launched 20 rockets into the Golan Heights, which were luckily taken out by the Iron Dome there. If, you know, for people who haven't been to Israel, Syrian border is obviously right next door, and the Iranians have encroached closer and closer on that border, and the Israelis have made it very clear that they are not going to allow Iran a foothold in a country that is not theirs to fight a war against them. And the White House came out today in a refreshing statement, which is completely 180 from what the Obama administration would do with a moral equivalency, and condemned Iran for their behavior, backed Israel, and called on the rest of the world to do the same. And the most interesting thing to me is that allies in the Middle East who have been very hostile to Israel since its beginning, like Bahrain, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, are not only condemning Iran, but speaking out in defense of Israel's right to defend itself against Iran's aggression. So that's where we are today. How we move forward on the deal from now is somewhat of a question mark. The Iranians are saying that they're going to now dump a whole bunch more money into their ballistic missile program, which kind of proves the point. They're burning American flags and chanting death to America. But one thing that's interesting to look at is the Iranian economy, at least what I've read, is worse than the Venezuelan economy at this point. And pulling out of the deal and taking away that cash flow of business to the regime could lead to somewhat of a collapse, because the people there have been protesting for weeks against the government for the horrible economic conditions that they've imposed, and not spending the money that they were supposed to get out of this deal on people, but rather dumping it again into terrorism and to their missile program.
And so that kind of speaks
where we are.
That kind of speaks to my my optimistic take. You know, I'm of mixed feelings on this whole thing, but I'm more on the optimistic side that, you know, ending this deal in conjunction with what the actions that Israel has taken is going to put an unprecedented amount of pressure on this regime and should, I'm hopeful, give momentum to that very real reform movement that is happening within the citizenry of Iran.
Well, I think that's the key point, right? Within the citizenry of Iran. This isn't the United States or Israel saying that there needs to be regime change for the sake of regime change because the Iranians are led by terrible people. I mean, they believe that they're terrible people, that they're dictators, that they have an ironclad tyrannical fist over their citizenry. But the difference here is that, you know, under Barack Obama in 2009, the same kind of movement was happening, and he ignored it. And this time around, we're not getting too involved with bolstering that movement. However, we're not getting in the way of it either by emboldening a regime that only has intentions of spending the money on attacking what they perceive as enemies.
How much can you put on the decision by President Donald Trump and the Iran nuke deal on, and sort of our overall stance with Israel, on the level of support that we're now seeing beyond the U.S. when it comes to Israel and this most recent clash with Iran?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to point out that the media and the Obama bros who put the Iran deal together, like Ben Rhodes and Tommy Veeder, have been arguing dishonestly that all of the allies are upset with us for pulling out of the Iran deal, and that's just not true. The UK, the Germans, and the French are upset with us, but the people in the Middle East who are also our allies and closest to the problem are cheering the move. I already mentioned them, Bahrain, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. So this idea that it's everybody's mad at us for doing this, this isn't true. The second thing is, there used to be, for 8 years, this bogus moral equivalency that the Obama administration would put on Israel and Hamas, or Israel and Hezbollah, or Israel and Iran. And anytime Israel was under attack, the first time I went there was in 2014 during the Gaza war when they were sending rockets into Israel from the south, the Obama administration would come out and say, Israel needs to show restraint in its response, even though Hamas was targeting civilians with rocket attacks by the dozens every single day. That is no longer the case. Again, if you look at the statement that was put out by the White House this morning, they roundly condemn the Iranian regime. They don't mention Israel's part of it at all, except for to say that they back their actions to take out the Iranian targets in Syria. They're not telling Israel to show any kind of restraint, and they're kind of just letting them do what they need to do to defend their country. And they're not drawing this bogus moral equivalence between, defending yourself and your civilians from rocket attacks and terrorist organizations, including Iran.
How big? Well, I'll go here because I want to ask you a personal question about your time that you spent over in Israel. But let's switch over for just a moment to the moving of the embassy. We talked with Pete Hegseth earlier in the week, and it's not being talked about a lot. The story that I had earlier in the week was simply a story talking about how the first signs were being placed, saying this is where the embassy is going to be in the region. And Pete spoke to how historic this actually is and how we can't really even overstate like how historic this is. Can you talk a bit about the moving of this embassy in light of the, our conversation right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. And I'm glad that they're doing it. This is not a temporary move because it is permanent, meaning that our embassy will be in Jerusalem. But they're moving the embassy, quote, into the consulate that is already there. And then they're going to build a new one because the consulate is quite small, actually. But, the concern at the beginning was, okay, they're going to say that they're moving it, but it's going to take 5 years to build a new one. And I think the administration went, okay, we're not going to take 5 years to do that. We'll just have a temporary one at the consulate now and then build the other one up to, the security standards that we need. But it's really important. And we're not the only ones who are doing this. We started the ball rolling, but Guatemala is doing it. There are a number of other countries that are also going to move their embassy. It simply just has embraced this idea that Congress has put forward and Israel has acknowledged for since its founding, that Jerusalem is the capital, and everybody knows it, and it's just about time that we dealt in reality rather than in this world of pretending it's not actually the case.
When it comes to the current conflict, you know, for lack of a better word, of what took place overnight with some of these airstrikes taking place, is there any reason for you to suspect that, you know, this is not necessarily anything new, that, you know, this battle's been going on for a long time and it flares up and we know how that plays out? Is there any concern this time around of this broadening? I know I read some articles earlier this week talking about this moving from essentially a proxy war to more of a direct conflict between Israel and Iran. Do you have concern over that?
I think it's about time. I think it's about time that Israel was able to respond in the way that they need to stop Iran from continually encroaching on their territory. You know, whether that will result in, quote, all-out war, I don't know. Things can always escalate. But it would be worse if Israel continued to allow them to build up military sites right on their border for an all-out war, not on the other side of Syria against Iranian targets, but with Israeli civilians right in the crosshairs. And quite frankly, they already are, because Iran is firing rockets into the country, right? So that's always a concern. However, I think it's about time that the Israelis took care of the Iranians, and based on who's backing them in the region, I think that they're completely justified in doing it now. Everyone's kind of sick of Iran's behavior, and they're sick of the way that they've taken over territory, the way that they operate, and so I think that they're totally justified.
One more. We got about a minute left, and just a quick take on this. When you look at what's happened with North Korea so far, you know, the releasing of these hostages, what's happening with Israel and this nuclear deal and the support that Israel's getting, how much of this can we truly put on the decision making of President Donald Trump, and how much of it should we put on, well, he's the figurehead, but there's also a lot of good people around him? Where do you place most of the credit when it comes to these issues?
I think it's both. I think that his attitude and his, you know, the way that he's approached foreign policy is different, and we've all been a little bit scared at times with the way that he's tweeted out certain things.
Sure.
But it's clearly working, and I think that respect on the global stage is something that is really important. And I think that, you know, people respect us now. They might disagree, but they at least respect us. So I think that he deserves a lot of credit for the way that things are going and for making bold decisions like moving the embassy, despite everyone saying they were going to do it on the campaign trail for the last, you know, 30 years and never actually doing it. Same going for the Iran deal. You know, he gave everybody a chance for a year and a half to bring him options about how to fix it. They failed to do so. He was open to their commentary and changes, and he made the tough decision to get rid of it. So I think he deserves a lot of credit.
Katie Pavlich from Fox News, thank you so much. Always enjoy our Thursday chats, and I'm really looking forward to catching up with you again next week.
Absolutely. Talk to you guys soon. Have a good weekend.
Take care.
Huh.
Looks like we made it.
One more show tomorrow, but holy cow.
Yeah, man. If you missed any of the show, get the IR Radio app. Download the app. It's free and easy. We've got a Justice and Drew channel there. Just a cavalcade of amazing guests on today's show. Tomorrow, we've got the Friday Roundtable. I believe it's a Roundtable Classic. I believe it's Representative Nick Zerwas.
Anything's possible at this point.
I believe it's comedian Brian Miller. We also have Tom Emmer and a parody song contest.
Good job today, Sam.
Tomorrow. Thank you. Well done.
Good job, team. Let's do it again tomorrow, shall we?
We're here at 6.
I don't want nobody.
Have a wonderful day.
Give me nothing. Open up the door. I'll get them myself. I don't give me integration. Give me true communication. I don't give me sorrow. I won't eat.
I'm Chris Addison. Here's